Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
The question is,
radical left.
Will you shut up,
man? Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on
so
your list?
Right.
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's going to pack the court.
We have ended.
No.
So what did Americans learn last night in the most disgraceful presidential debate in living memory? You learned, once again, about the abject, sorry state of American political discourse. The American people also learned that the sitting president of the United States, when given the opportunity, would not denounce white supremacy.
What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a name.
White supremacists and
white
supremacists and right
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
And he would not say that he will accept the results of an independently certified election in November.
If I see tens of thousands of ballots being manipulated, I can't go along with that. And I'll tell
and what
you what,
does that
from
mean,
a common sense,
does that mean you're
going
you to
tell
your people to take to
it
the
It means
screen?
You have a fraudulent election.
So this hour in Point, we're going to be talking about last night's presidential debate, and we want to know what you learned, what you thought of it. Send us a tweet at On Point Radio, or we're at Facebook as well, at On Point Radio. Well, joining us now is McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. He's with us from Alexandria, Virginia. McKay, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox. Jane, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
So no one thought that this was going to be a dull debate going in. Spectacle is sort of the de facto temperature for American politics now. But McKay, did you expect to see what actually unfolded last night?
It was worse than I thought it would be. I think I expected some version of antics. I expected the president to interrupt, as he did many times during the 2016 election and through the debates that he was in. I don't think I quite anticipated the level, the kind of temperature of the debate. You know, from the very beginning, the president came out clearly fired up, angry, ready to kind of brawl. And you went through some of those lowlights there. I mean, just in this hour and a half, we have the president pointedly refused to condemn white supremacists who supported him. He attacked Joe Biden's son for struggling with cocaine addiction. He undermined the credibility of the election, saying that we might have a fraudulent election. And you know, so many times derailed any semblance of a coherent debate by talking over his opponent to the point where we would get into a situation where all three men, both candidates and the moderator, were speaking over each other. I'm very curious what we'll learn about the ratings of this debate, and especially if there was any kind of drop off, because I said last night that if I wasn't professionally obligated to watch that debate, I don't know if I could have lasted past the first few minutes. It was pretty difficult to watch.
Yeah. Jane, what about you?
Yeah, it was funny because I think that I've been thinking a lot about this campaign and how particularly the Trump campaign appears to be making a play for the base, and not just the base, but the base of the base. If you had a foundation to a foundation, that appears to be to whom he's appealing. I want to quote Hot Air writer and town hall writer Guy Benson, who basically said, "Hardcore supporters will call Trump's approach needed and appropriate aggressiveness, but everyone else who is not a hardcore Trump supporter or people who are, you know, within those camps are going to say, like, that seemed ridiculous." I think that this debate, it wasn't so much of a debate. And I think that our understanding of what a debate is supposed to be perhaps has been changed over the last 15 to 20 years. But I really think that seemed more like a strange play of some sort. It was a very strange event that I don't think most Americans want to watch, because I think most Americans there's so much happening right now. We just learned that Disney's laying off 28,000 people. And I think that for a lot of people, if you watch that, where did they see a conversation about what's happening with the American people and one that didn't seem like a self-aggrandizing hate fest?
Yeah. So I want to talk more about what the tone of last night means for the state of American political discourse, laid bare for all the world to see. But I also, but before we do that, I want to dig deeper into the fact that so the two men on stage last night want to be the leader of this nation. So ostensibly, the debates are supposed to be the opportunity where they speak to the American people, share their vision, and make their case for why they should lead this country. There, after the debate, even Chris Christie, the president's own debate coach, said that, you know, that President Trump might have come in too hot and all that heat might have obscured the light that the president had to offer. So what light was that? So let me just talk about two particular moments. McKay, you mentioned them, but we should hear them. First of all, there was this moment where Fox News' Chris Wallace, who moderated last night, asked President Trump if he would condemn white supremacist violence in this country. And here is how the president responded.
I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you, what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call him? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a
left-wing.
This is a left-wing problem.
White supremacists.
So the president, they're opting not to say, I condemn white supremacist violence. Later, at the very end of the debate, Wallace asked the candidates if they would pledge not to declare victory until the election results are independently certified. And here's how President Trump responded.
President Trump, you
go first. I'm urging my supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, because that's what has to happen. I am urging them to do it. As you know, today there was a big problem. In Philadelphia, they went in to watch. They were called poll watchers, a very safe, very nice thing. They were thrown out. They weren't allowed to watch. You know why? Because bad things happen in Philadelphia, bad things. And I am urging my people. I hope it's going to be a fair election. If it's a fair election, I am 100% on board. But if I see tens of thousands of ballots being manipulated, I can't go along with that. And I'll tell you what.
What does that
from
mean?
A common sense,
does that mean you're going to tell your means. People to take to
it
the street?
It means you have a fraudulent election. You're
and
sending
you
out 80
do?
Million
and what
ballots.
Would you do
they're,
about
not,
that?
They're not equipped to. These people aren't equipped to handle it, number one. Number two, they cheat.
President Trump, at the end of the presidential debate last night, McKay and Jane, what vision, what did the president say? Those two clips taken together about not denouncing white supremacist violence, not being willing to say he would accept the results of an independently certified election. What is the sitting president saying about what he thinks of American democracy right now? McKay, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think clearly what the worst case scenario is from those comments is that he implicitly and came right up to the line of explicitly encouraging supporters to use physical force to secure him an election victory. And if he doesn't win or is not given that victory, to react with physical force. I mean, he's talking about poll watchers. He's saying that that Chris Wallace even asked, are you going to ask your supporters to take to the streets? And the president didn't say one thing or the other. You know, it's been clear from the beginning that this president does not even really feign a reverence for democratic traditions in the way that presidential candidates of both parties historically have, right? I mean, even in 2016, you'll recall, he won that election while losing the popular vote and insisted that the only reason he didn't win the popular vote was because there had been widespread voter fraud, which was not supported by any evidence, even after there were, you know, investigations of it. And so making him kind of the first, I think, presidential victor in a campaign to then say that there was voter fraud in the same campaign. So I think that we're seeing a continuation of his kind of indifference at best to the idea of America's healthy democracy, which for a long time, it should be noted, has been kind of one of America's proudest traditions and something that, everyone, regardless of ideology and party, has held up as a model for the world.
Mm. Jane, what do you think?
I think that one of the challenges that we face here is that we are dealing with someone who will say things for the pure purpose of saying something and then leave it to the rest of us to interpret it. Mm-hmm. And what Trump wants and Trump values most is attention, and whether or not that attention is good or bad. This is a former reality television show host who thinks about everything in those terms. You heard a lot of conversation yesterday about, oh, Biden with a secret earpiece or Biden taking a drug test, which is pro wrestling tactics. He's trying to generate some cheap heat from the audience in Cleveland. But I also think that this indicates to me, and there's been a lot of writing on this, is that Trump's idea of a second term, there are no new ideas. He came in 2016 with this purported populism, but what we've seen is that that populism is essentially being Paul Ryan, but louder and meaner. And so I think it really indicates that this is an attention-grabbing presidential campaign from an attention-grabbing president who doesn't really care that much about democratic norms one way or the other.
And even when Chris Wallace tried to challenge President Trump about the lack of new ideas, the second question was about health care and no new plan from the GOP. Trump didn't even let him finish that question. He wouldn't even broach the idea that there were no new ideas.
Yeah, it seems as if his concept of there is no idea here. I've long theorized, and obviously this is just my opinion, but I've long theorized that Trump's main value in 2016 was to win the election, not necessarily being president, but win the election. And now we've seen 4 years later that so much of his purported ideas just became the Republican Party platform of 2016. And I think that that really indicates a lack of nuance and a lack of thought.
Well, Jane Costin and McKay Coppins, stand by. We're talking about what the nation, what the world saw in last night's first presidential general election debate. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about what the American people actually learned from last night's first presidential debate between former Vice President Joe Biden and President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. Jane Costin is also with us. She's senior politics reporter at Vox. Now, the debate was held in Cleveland, Ohio. So let's listen to a little bit of Trump and Biden sparring over who has done more for voters in Ohio.
I was asked to bring back Chrysler and General Motors. We brought them back right here in the state of Ohio and Michigan. He blew it. They're gone. He blew it. And in fact, they're going.
Ohio had the best year it's ever had last year. Michigan had the best year they've ever had.
That is not
true. Many car companies came in from Germany, from Japan, went to Michigan, went to Ohio.
They're not having
that. And they didn't come in with you.
Mr. Vice President, go ahead.
A moment from last night's debate. Well, joining us now from Cleveland is Nick Castell, reporter for WCPN and WVIZ Idea Stream. He covers Northeast Ohio's public radio and television stations, and he covers politics and government. Nick, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So Ohio, always a key swing state here. How do you think or what do we know about how voters in Ohio responded to what happened last night in Cleveland?
Well, you know, we did have a reporter who was out with some Democrats and Republicans in the Cleveland area to get their feeling. I think it seemed like the read from Democrats was, you know, obviously a very messy debate, but they felt that Joe Biden said what he needed to say. On the Republican side, there were some complaints about the moderator. Someone called Chris Wallace a rhino, a Republican in name only, which is a curious thing to say about a journalist. But, you know, listen, Donald Trump won Ohio by 8 points 4 years ago. So, you know, Ohio was not as close as it had been in past elections. I think Ohio Democrats certainly want to say that Ohio is in play this time around. Sometimes national Democrats maybe aren't so certain, but at least recent polling shows that it's much closer with Biden than it was 4 years ago.
How much closer?
Well, you know, the polling averages put it pretty much neck and neck. I mean, some show one up or the other up, but not giving Trump at least the 8-point lead that we saw in the election results in 2016.
Okay, so what are the issues that really matter to Ohio voters? And do you think, as you watched last night, did they hear any sort of meaningful engagement about those issues?
Well, I think the meaningful engagement question has been handled ably by our other panelists in the past segment here. But, you know, one issue that I guess was not mentioned in full force, but this whole issue of has the past year or so been a good one for Ohio? I mean, one issue that has caught a lot of attention here was the closure of a General Motors plant in Lordstown, Ohio. In fact, the state is now trying to claw back some tax credits that were given to GM as part of the, you know, the promise of keeping them here. That's been a big issue. And I know Democrats have tried to play up the fact that Trump went to the Lordstown, Youngstown area and told people, don't sell your houses because it's going to get a lot better. And then they were faced with this crushing news about the GM plant. And so that's been a thing of huge importance, you know, first, just for people's livelihoods in Northeast Ohio, but, you know, as well as the symbolic importance of has this administration delivered on its promises to industrial America?
So then tell me more, because there was some talk about the economy overall, about manufacturing. There were claims made back and forth about sort of the state of American manufacturing prior to 2016 and now. I mean, do you think that that Ohio voters heard anything that helped them understand what the next 4 years might be for them, depending on who gets put in the White House?
Well, I may not be able to say yes to that question because it was such a chaotic debate.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest with you, most of my focus in the evening was watching how Cleveland handled, you know, this sudden responsibility it had to host this debate. But, you know, there's also a longer term reality that, you know, the manufacturing employment picture is changing in this country. And although productivity may be going up, employment just in the manufacturing sector is not where it was in Ohio in past decades. And that's just a reality that we've been grappling with for a long time here.
Okay. So since I appreciate you pointing out that Cleveland as a city had the responsibility of managing this debate last night, how did that go?
Well, you know, I was out on the street a little bit with demonstrators. We had other reporters who were out there, too, as well as going inside. It was extremely locked down. There were a lot of metal barricades all over the place, keeping people out of the main debate venue. Police officers from many different agencies. The Ohio National Guard was also on the ground. So it really was a show of force from the law enforcement agencies of Ohio. There was a pretty sizable demonstration of several hundred, if not 1,000 people who came out to protest. It does not appear to have really gotten very out of hand. I believe there are about 4 arrests total. So overall, a peaceful night, and people were out to make their voices heard on issues like climate change or racial justice. And you know, I think they probably came away feeling like they were able to say their piece.
Well, Nick Castell, reporter for WCPN and WVIZ IdeaStream. Nick, thank you so very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Nick spoke to us from Cleveland, Ohio. Okay, so Jane and McKay, it's interesting because, you know, in back in the before times, right, debates, whether or not they actually swung any particular voters or helped the undecided decide, I think the traditional thinking was it's an opportunity, a very direct opportunity for the campaigns, for the candidates to speak directly to the American people, right? And so there's something that the campaigns still believe they can get out of these debates. So, Jane, let me just start with you. I mean, what did the Trump campaign think that they needed to get out of the debates, and did they?
I think that one of the challenges we faced is that I genuinely think that occasionally the Trump campaign gets wrapped up and gets a little too high on their own supply, so to speak. So if you'll recall, a couple of weeks ago, there was a lot of talk about how Biden isn't even going to show up for the debate, and this debate is going to be a walkover because Biden is senile. And you saw, the writer Ala Pundit over at hotair.com essentially said, like, the GOP was lowering the bar so low for Biden that it essentially laid down the ground. And so I think it's not so much what Trump or the Trump campaign thought that they could get out of the debate, but the idea of what Biden would be like during the debate, which was essentially they made it seem as if there's a chance Biden might not even show up or might not even know where he was. And that clearly didn't happen and clearly was not going to happen, because Biden is an actual human being who was actually going to show up at this debate because we live an actual life. But I think that there's a sense that Trump is extraordinarily reliant on the views of people who already like him. He has a real feedback loop that takes place through Fox News. And if Fox News makes him mad, he goes over to One America Network. And so I think that the idea of the debate was not necessarily to convince anyone or cajole anyone, but it was to speak again exactly to the same base, the base that he cares about most and the base that he hears from the most.
And McKay, what do you think?
Well, I thought, turning to Joe Biden, you know, he clearly had some of the most memorable moments in the debate were when Joe Biden, you know, said things like "keep yapping, man," or "will you please shut up" to the president. You know, those were not ordinary things that you hear in a debate. And you already see the Biden campaign trying to kind of turn those into viral moments. There's a video on Twitter that the campaign has put out where Trump is kind of speaking over everyone, and they put a crying emoji over the president's face and have him crying throughout the debate. But, you know, I actually think the strongest moments Biden had were when he turned to the camera, more or less tried to ignore President Trump and spoke directly about the response to the coronavirus and how it could have been better, the struggling economy, his kind of campaign thesis, which is that if he's elected, he'll be able to restore a sense of stability to the United States. You know, those moments when he was kind of taking the more traditional path of speaking directly to the voters and trying to deliver his message, I think those aren't the most exciting moments in the debate. They're probably not the ones that are going to go viral or the ones we're going to talk about. But you had tens and tens of millions of people watching last night, most likely. And I think that he tried to use the debate to kind of drive home his core campaign messages.
Okay, so let's listen to a little bit of exactly this aspect of the debate last night. Here's former Vice President Biden talking about the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus pandemic, specifically regarding the impact that pandemic has had on Black Americans.
One in 1,000 African Americans has been killed because of the coronavirus. And if he doesn't do something quickly, by the end of the year, one in 500 will have been killed. One in 500 African Americans. This man is a savior of African Americans. This man cares at all. This man's done virtually nothing.
So that's Joe Biden talking about the coronavirus pandemic last night. There's a couple of more clips from Biden that I want to play. One of them has to do with, and actually the following two you're going to hear have to do with maybe places in which he had to step away from issues or perspectives on issues that are near and dear to the Democratic base. So first of all, let's listen to Chris Wallace asking Biden if he would add more justices to the Supreme Court if elected. And Biden avoided the question, saying that the American people should speak instead. So let's listen to that exchange.
You should go out and vote. You're in voting now. Vote and let your senators know how strongly you feel. Vote now.
Are you going to pack the
Make
court?
Sure you, in fact, let people know
you're a senator. The
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
The question is, the question is,
justice, the radical question, left.
Will you shut
who is
up,
on,
man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on
so
your
right.
List?
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's going to pack the court.
We have ended. No, no.
So that's an exchange, which the president interjected in, obviously, on the question of court packing. Now, about climate change, the former vice president said his plan is not the same as the Green New Deal.
The Green New Deal will pay for itself as we move forward. We're not going to build plants that, in fact, are great polluting plants.
So do you We're support the Green New Deal?
Pardon me?
Do you support
No, I don't support the Green
oh,
New Deal.
Oh, you don't? Oh, well, that's a big statement.
I support
that means you just lost the radical left.
I support the
don't.
Biden plan that I put forward.
Okay.
The Biden plan, which is different than what he calls the radical Green New Deal.
So, Jane, let me ask you this. Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal, she posed this question that perhaps Biden didn't help himself with the Democratic base because of the moments like this where he had to distance himself from the Green New Deal, from the question of court packing, et cetera. And she points out that the Democratic Party, between the progressive wing and the more centrist parts of the party, is still divided. So it could – what do you think about that?
I mean, my first response was, are you kidding me? After the past 3 months of hearing that Joe Biden was a thoroughfare to the radical left, and Joe Biden was basically, you know, a member of the Gang of Four, and we were facing the Cultural Revolution in the streets of American cities. Now the issue is that Joe Biden is too mean to the left. It's interesting because Trump actually tweeted earlier this morning about how, you know, how Biden had been insulting to Bernie Sanders, which goes against the entire campaign premise of the last several months, which is that Biden is a radical leftist and that, you know, that he would just basically let Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez take over the country and we'd just be facing a, you know, a Jewish government. And it's so strange to see the idea that no, this is a real challenge for the Democratic left, a group of people whom, you know, Republicans have been asking Biden to reject over and over and over again. And then Biden rejects them and he's like, there's a real issue here. And so it just seems as if this is the case of excessive punditry. And I think that this is something that is not going to be an actual problem, especially with the Supreme Court at stake, especially because this isn't a change election generally being if you don't have an incumbent involved. And like, it just seems as if this is punditry gone too far, in my view.
Yeah, we've got a bad case of excessive punditry. Point taken. Good diagnosis. McKay, your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, so I think what I would say is that it is unquestionable that if Joe Biden is elected, one of the central political stories of his presidency will be the tension between his White House and the left wing of the party. You know, there are very interesting debates going on in the Democratic Party right now. There is a wide variety of views, and there are people who, you know, seriously disagree with each other on core issues and core values, I would even argue. And though a lot of that drama will play out in the Biden White House. But, you know, Joe Biden a few times throughout the debate tried to remind President Trump, and I think, you know, more directly American voters, that he won the primary beating the left wing of his party, right? He defeated Bernie Sanders. He defeated other much more progressive members of his party. And he did that in large part by, you know, telling Democratic voters that he was going to be the one who could beat Donald Trump because he wasn't going to be a radical. He wasn't going to embrace the more aggressive ideas that are being, you know, amplified by people like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, there was this strange thing that kept happening throughout the debate where Donald Trump would say, oh, well, you're not allowed to say this because you'll get in trouble with the left wing of your party. And then several times Joe Biden just went ahead and said the thing that Trump said he wouldn't be able to say. And it was this interesting pattern where I think that, you know, Trump was clearly trying to brand Biden as a left wing radical. And I think this goes back to what Jane was saying earlier, which is that Trump, I think, has tricked himself into believing that he's running against the candidate that he's trying to create, right? He's trying to create in the minds of voters a Joe Biden who is held captive by the left wing of his party. But then when he was actually on stage with him and tried to point that out, Joe Biden refuted it several times. And I think that was kind of a strategic miscalculation by Donald Trump, if nothing else.
Well, we are talking this hour about what the nation, what the world saw on stage in Cleveland last night in the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden and what we learned. And listeners are pouring in their observations about what they learned. Whimsy Words tells us Trump laid out in no uncertain terms that he had no respect for our government, is unapologetically racist, and incapable of any compassion or empathy beyond his own distorted reality. And Terrence Mohoruk writes to us, last night's performance by both of these men demonstrated that neither is capable of leadership. Neither man has the confidence to allow the process to play out. Both are shallow and defensive. The world is watching in horror that these are the best we have. So what did you learn when you watched the presidential debate last night? Send us your thoughts on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be back with more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about what Americans learned about the state of their democracy, about the two men who wish to be president of the United States, what we learned from last night's first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I'm joined today by McKay Coppin, staff writer for The Atlantic. Jane Costin is also with us. She's senior politics reporter at Vox. Let's listen to a quick moment where Fox News moderator Chris Wallace asked President Trump about recent reporting just out from The New York Times, an analysis of information about Donald Trump's taxes that found that he paid only $750 in federal income taxes in both 2016 and 2017. And here is that exchange.
Is it true that you paid $750 in federal income taxes each of those 2 years?
I paid millions of dollars in taxes, millions of dollars of income tax. And let me just tell you, there was a story in one of the papers.
I paid
$38 million 1 year. I paid $27 million.
Show us your tax returns.
I went. You'll see it as soon as it's finished. You'll see it.
That was from the presidential debate last night. Now, tomorrow on the show, we're going to spend the entire hour going deep on this reporting from The New York Times on the president's taxes. And we want to hear from you in anticipation of tomorrow's show about what you think about the revelations from The New York Times that the president paid next to no dollars in federal taxes for several years. Call us with your thoughts at 617 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And let us know. The president, according to the Times, paid just $750 in 2016 and 2017. In comparison to that, how much did you pay? Again, 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. But let's continue on talking about last night's debate, because the president very deliberately began bulldozing the debate just a few minutes in. And it began when Fox News' Chris Wallace tried to ask just the second question of the night. And as the night continued, he repeatedly tried to wrestle control back.
I think that the country would be better served if we allowed both people to speak with fewer interruptions. I'm appealing to you, sir, to do that.
Well, and him, too.
Well, frankly, you've been doing more interrupting than he
has. Well, that's all right, but he does plenty.
Well, less than, sir, less than
plenty.
No, less than you have.
Well, Martha Raddatz is chief global affairs correspondent at ABC News. She has sat in that very chair, the presidential debate moderator's chair. Here's how she saw what happened with Wallace last night.
This was truly history-making and not the kind of history anyone should want to make. Chris was put in a position that made the position we were in 2016, when Donald Trump was lurking around the stage and interrupting, look like nothing.
That is not a comprehensive plan.
That is absolutely a big thing. That was the worst part of Obamacare. Chris, that was the worst part of Obamacare.
Let me ask my question.
Well, I'll ask Joe.
I think Chris tried to do everything he could to keep that debate on track. The only thing I can say is I think I would have just stopped it for a moment. I mean, I always tell people, when you're doing debate, it's when your parenting skills come out, and they just needed to time out.
$1 billion if you
that
get rid
is
of
absolutely you know what you're wait, not
when
true.
You're, on tape,
you're
doing it.
You're going to have
tape.
True.
Gentlemen, I hate to
Chris,
raise my voice, but it seems to be, why shouldn't I be different than the two of you?
The first debate I did in 2012 with then Vice President Joe Biden and Paul Ryan. It was a real debate. It was a real conversation. Americans could have walked away from that and said, I know more about those candidates. And I think the American people are far more well served when that civility takes over. I think the Presidential Commission is going to have to take a very hard look at how these next debates proceed. They can't have another debate like this. No one wants to watch that. No one wants to watch a mud fight like that. So I think they're going to have to either have a very hard talk with the Trump campaign in particular, because that is where it went off the rails right away. I know there was a lot of comment on social media and Twitter last night about, can you just kill the microphone? I'm not sure that would even work. It just has to be a very hard conversation about not wanting to proceed if that's the way it's going to go.
Martha Raddatz, chief global affairs correspondent at ABC News, who has sat in that moderator's chair. So, Jane and McKay, I mean, look, we are living definitely in the world where the medium is the message as well, and a lot of focus on Chris Wallace's both valiant and vain attempts to get this debate back on the rails. Is there any more that he could have or should have done, Jane?
I don't think so, because I think that this was entirely the strategy that Trump had, was just to bulldoze through this. And it's interesting, though, because as I said, that this appears to be a base strategy. If you said that, if you wanted this to be an effort to talk to the American people and to, more importantly, appeal to Americans who don't already support you, I'm aware that there are very few undecided voters, but undecided voters still matter in this race, as they do in every race, then he would not have spent the entire time being extraordinarily belligerent. You know, to quote Guy Benson again, peppering nearly every exchange with incessant interruptions. And I think that there very much is a sense that what Joe Biden has done throughout this campaign is let the focus be on Donald Trump and let Donald Trump be the center of attention. And Donald Trump is absolutely fine with that, because Donald Trump really enjoys talking about Donald Trump and talking to people who want to talk about Donald Trump. And so I think that there really is a sense here that what he went into this with was with the intention of bulldozing everyone involved, including the moderator. And especially because, you know, you got a lot of kind of Trump media people talking about how Chris Wallace was rude to Trump in some ways. But I think that in a certain sense, I feel like that's motivated reasoning. You need to be looking for that in some senses in order to really see that. And I think that there's really, I don't know, it's strange to see someone whose idea of taking part in a debate is to attempt to shut down the debate by running over it. It kind of, you know, it reminds me of a lot of the right-wing critiques of how sometimes college students react to speakers they don't like by trying to shut them down. Well, this was cancel culture on the American debate stage.
So, you know, McKay, I full disclosure, I mean, obviously, I have never sat in that moderator's chair. Don't really plan to in the near future at any time. So I can't necessarily... I'm saying with respect that I actually disagree with some of what we just heard Martha Raddatz say, because, you know, she said, well, maybe she's not sure about the idea of just turning off microphones. Maybe we have to talk that the debate commission has to talk to the Trump campaign a little bit more. But you got to get your parenting skills on. I mean, all of these things. Look, you know, with a toddler, sometimes you just walk away and let them have their tantrum and they're done. And then you come back and reason with them. That is just not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the president of the United States. And so when we've reached a point where, you know, there's a legitimate question about whether the debates should go on, that is damaging to our democracy, right? Because how are voters going to be able to, you know, at this late stage of the game, especially in the middle of a pandemic, hear from the campaign or from the candidates themselves? I mean, I feel like America is the one that keeps losing here.
Right. Yeah, I would say that, you know, first of all, I'm just not in the cancel the debates camp. You know, I'm one of my colleagues at The Atlantic wrote a piece about that this morning. And, you know, made a persuasive case that this was not, you know, this was an embarrassing spectacle, that voters could not possibly have gotten anything out of it. I take all those points, but I still think it's better for the debates to happen, even in this chaotic, messy format, than to not happen, because at the very least, you are seeing the president in who he is. You're seeing Joe Biden and how he reacts to the situation. It's, you know, you're at least still seeing the candidates try to make their case. You know, as for like the smaller fixes, things like cutting the mic, I mean, the problem you have with all of this is that the president just does not care about the debate rules. I mean, that was made obviously clear throughout last night. I think if you tried to you know, institute something where you cut his mic, he would just start yelling, you know, so that his voice got picked up by Joe Biden's mic. Or maybe he'd walk over to the other podium and use that microphone. I mean, there's no telling. He's completely unpredictable. But I just don't think that there are any minor fixes here that would have made it more workable. One thing I will say just quickly is, you know, I there's a lot of talk about media bias. I think one true fact of media bias is that we often are biased in the sense that we have solidarity with each other. And I kind of agree with others who have made the point that, you know, Chris Wallace did make an effort, and I really don't know what he could have done differently in that situation to gain control of the debate. I think that he did his best. He's moderated other debates and done a good job. I think that people are directing their ire at him when you know, he didn't really have the tools to take control of the situation.
So just, you know, thinking out loud here about the mic shutoff thing or other sort of design fixes. I mean, what if in the next debate, presidential debate, Steve Scully just said, you know, these are the rules, and restate the rules clearly. They have been agreed upon by everyone. These are the rules. And for this debate, whichever candidate chooses to violate those rules, we are going to just turn off his mic until he chooses to accept them and just see what happens. I mean, I think we don't know what's going to happen. Of course, I mean, it'll probably just be even more of a spectacle and unwatchable. But I think one of the things that both of you have said is, we will continue to see the truth of who these men are. I mean, what's wrong with that? Why not try that?
No, I think there's a case for that. It, you know, I would be interested to see how the next moderators use that tool. I mean, for all you can say about, you know, who the current president is and the situation, it does take quite a bit of, spunk, to use an old word, to be to be the moderator and shut off the president's microphone, right? I think a lot of people would cheer that on. And I think that you're right, that if you just lay it out as these are the rules and this is what we're going to do. I think the problem, obviously, is that both campaigns have to agree to that for that to work. You know, the debate commission has to get sign on with both campaigns. And I do not see the Trump campaign agreeing to that.
All right. Well, we have Dori Scheimer, On Point producer here, who's been following the very vocal social media input from listeners on this hour. Dori, give us a couple of comments here.
Yeah, it's hard to believe people have something to say about that debate. Bill Sherman said on Twitter, "What I learned from the debate last night is how far apart we are as a country. I was embarrassed knowing the world was watching our president act like a child." Rachel Conley tweeted us, "I learned last night that we are beyond politics, are now experiencing a threat to our democracy and the American experiment."
Okay, so just a little bit of what people are saying. I want to play one more clip here from last night, because there was also a moment where former Vice President Joe Biden brought up the memory of his late son, Beau, who did serve in the United States military. And Biden was raising a point about the president's reported criticism of members of the military. So let's listen to that exchange.
He was not a loser. He was a patriot. And the people left behind were heroes.
Really?
And I resent
Are you talking
like
about Hunter?
Hell.
Are you talking about
I'm
Hunter?
I'm talking about my son, Bo Biden. You're talking
about
Beau.
I don't know Bo. I know Hunter. Yeah, Hunter, you know, Hunter got thrown out of the military. He was thrown out, dishonorably discharged.
That's not true.
For
he wasn't dishonorably
cocaine use. And he didn't have a job until you became vice president. Once you
None
became
of that
vice president,
true.
He made a fortune in Ukraine, in China, in Moscow,
that is simply
and various
not
other places.
True.
He
my
made
son,
a fortune.
Gentlemen, my son.
And he didn't have a job.
My son, like a lot of people we know at home, had a drug problem. He's overtaken it. He's fixed it. He's worked on it. And I'm proud of him.
Former Vice President Joe Biden and President Trump last night. McKay and Jane, I want to just read to you the last graph from the piece that Dan Balls at The Washington Post wrote. He wrote that what will be remembered last night is the degree to which democracy itself has suffered and could suffer more as the election plays out to its conclusion. This has been called the most important election in generations. Some say in the life of this country. But that's not what people who tuned in saw. Partisans will call winners and losers as they see them, and those judgments will be predictable. Collectively, this was not a night when the country could claim victory. Instead, it was quite the opposite. That's what I keep coming back to and thinking, what did I learn last night? All I learned is how damaged American democracy has become. And what are we going to do about it between now and November, now and for the next many years? And I just wanted to, in the last 2 minutes that we have, hear, you know, from both of you about that fundamental question. Jane, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think that there's a sense, I would also say that perhaps our excessive focus on the presidency and the role of the presidency and the expanded power that the executive branch has held over the last 20 years really plays a part in this. But I would also say that democracy starts, and our understanding of democracy starts with the demos, starts with the people, starts with the people who are making these decisions and voting, people who are taking part in local and state elections. It takes, you know, one of the challenges we face with the nationalization of politics is that, you know, state concerns become national concerns, but that elides how much the individual voter and how much the individual person taking part in an election really does play a role, a critical role, in how we think about democracy. And I think that, yes, at the presidential level, this was a bananas pudding sauce of stupidity, but it was a bananas pudding sauce of stupidity that is the end run result of making the presidency into the most famous celebrity you can think of, who is the symbol of everything but can't really do very much at all because of how you know, the structures of our politics work. So I think that perhaps, if anything, this will encourage people to de-emphasize the presidency. I often think that this is perhaps the time for the Calvin Coolidge of some kind, a person who you don't really hear very much from, but also a person who is not required to be the symbol of or the antithesis of your politics. Yeah. And I think that it's important to take the politics back to the people to whom it belongs.
Well, you know what, McKay? I'm actually going to let Jane have the last word on that today. So
that's all right.
Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox, thank you so very much for being with us. And McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. McKay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.